be working just fine. I am not messing with that thing. It's like, it's working. Leave it alone for a while. See if it'll establish a base of solid uptime.
Talking about Windows Home Server 2011, then
talking about a RAID card that I stuck in there, the HighPoint 2720 RAID card. And I was having some problems getting things working the way I needed to, but I just started right over from scratch, basically, and I just took one step at a time, added one thing at a time, and got to a point where everything's up and running, and I said, okay, stop right here, and let's let this thing run for a month or so before I start playing around with add-ins, updates, and whatnot. And it's been rock solid.
What do you have on the end of the RAID?
What drives am I using?
Right.
I'm using four of the Samsung HD 204 UIs. They're the 2 terabyte green drives.
And you said four? You got four of them?
Four of them in a RAID 5. So, okay. You know, I got to say, I was getting pretty good streaming performance out of my Windows Home server. I have a version 1. I have an EX495, the old HP box sitting over there. And I love that box. It looks so cool. And I was getting pretty decent performance as far as streaming to my bedroom HT PC so we could sit there and watch a movie. But I have to admit that there would be occasional times when it would be a little bit of a glitch, you know, a little bit of a stutter. Nothing too serious, so I never really thought too much about it. Since I've been running off this RAID 5, I haven't seen anything yet, and I've watched probably a half a dozen movies with no stuttering, no hesitation. So I've got to think that the improved throughput of the RAID 5 has smoothed that right out for me.
Yeah, I would have to agree with you. Since I put mine in, I just have had zero issues with it. Well, Jay disappeared, so while we're waiting for him to come back, John, I haven't met you before, so if you would be kind enough to tell me a little bit about yourself.
Well, I guess I've been working in technology for 35 years. Or more than that, really, if you count time in school and stuff. And my undergrad is in EE from Rolla, and got my master's at Purdue a few years later. But most of my professional work had been with power systems, electric utilities. So I like big machines.
Yeah.
You know, megawatts instead of milliwatts.
The stuff that powers people's houses.
Yeah.
Sure.
So, I had dealt with PCs a lot, starting with the IBM PC and kind of moving forward from there. But then after probably a few years around 90, 91, 92, I kind of stalled a little bit as far as technology, busy with work and everything. And I've been kind of getting back into it the last few years since my son's gone to college and I've had more time and got into built my first home machine last year. That was an X58 using a gigabyte board. And basically, my son encouraged me to go with that because he didn't think I would be happy working with a lower tech type board. So he encouraged me. And then I had some problems with my home server, and I ended up working on rebuilding the power supply, putting that in. And that success continues to encourage more things. So,
John, when you say rebuild the power supply, what did? I mean, most of us just replace those things, right?
That's really, I had to replace it, but HP has a proprietary system, so you can't just go out and buy a generic. So what I had to do was go and buy something close and then rewire it so that it would work in the HP. And there's places on the internet that tell you how to redo the wiring and stuff. So, and that worked out pretty well. So since then, I upgraded the RAM on my 87 and the 4 gig, and I've upgraded the microprocessor, so it's pretty well maxed out now.
So what is the current configuration you have for hardware?
You're just talking about my server? Mm-hmm. I have just a EX487 with the new power supply and the 4 gig of RAM, 6.75 terabytes. Plus a 2 terabyte Western Digital Elements drive that I use for backups. I actually have two of them, and I cycle one between the house.
Is that just a USB?
It's just a USB.
Yeah.
And then I have an eSATA drive, one of those. I forget the model number, but it's the and a silver one, and I have a 2 terabyte drive in that, and I use that to back up the database.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Have you done any database restores? Have you done any PC restores with this?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I had some problems that I documented on the website. I'd had some problems with my X58. It wouldn't update the Service Pack 1 after I'd had it about 6 months. And it was just driving me crazy. I couldn't figure out what the problem was. So then I found out that Windows wasn't updating all the security updates that they were supposed to. So I wanted to trace the problem, and I thought it might have something to do with, well, I wasn't sure. So to trace it, I knew I was going to have to do something, either a complete rebuild or a restore or something. So that's when I went, and I had the experience of finding drivers for my X58.
Right, the 64-bit drivers.
Yeah, and I got inspiration from a guy on another site who found Vista drivers, because I would go and get 32-bit Win7 drivers.
Sure.
They were supposed to work, and they wouldn't work, but then I got the 32-bit Vista drivers, and those worked. So
those generally do, right.
And so finally started restoring the system, and I had backups, monthly backups, to the first time I had set the system up. I just kept going back further and further. And I kept finding more places where I was getting failed updates on security updates. And finally figured out the problem was I had Norton Utilities. And if you run Norton Utilities and you do a registry clean...
Say no to Norton Utilities. Do not do any registry clean. Okay, there, that's my little...
Well, you're speaking to the choir now.
Yeah,
you don't have to tell me that.
Yeah, okay, you're on board.
Maybe about a year and a half ago, it would have been good news to have gotten, but I found it out on my own. So I ended up rebuilding my entire system. But that was great in a way, because some of the people on the board gave me ideas on some areas to look at, because like Photoshop, you got to be careful. You have to uninstall them beforehand and everything, otherwise they...
Right, you lose your license activation.
Yeah. And then the things you have to do with iTunes and all that stuff, too. I did all that, but it was easier the second time.
A lot of work, yeah.
It was easier doing the install, and there was a lot of things that I did differently. Of course, I don't have Norton Utilities on it, so it runs faster, too.
John, what did you use to replace that?
Windows Security Essentials. It works pretty well. And then I use Windows Security Essentials. I have a virtual version of XP Pro running on my X58. And that works well in there, too.
Is that part of the XP mode of Windows 7?
Yeah, it's XP mode. You actually load down a XP Service Pack 3 Pro version and run it in that mode. And just for SNGs, I went and created a virtual machine on my X58 and put version 1 of Windows Home Server. And I just kind of play with it, but I'm not really doing anything with it. But I just use it to do things before I remote into my production version on the 487. And then what I'm talking to you on is the Acer Aspire 1810T. It's about the size of a netbook, but it has a dual-core microprocessor in it, so it's pretty hefty, and it's nice to haul around. And then for home theater, it's not really a home theater, but a PC, but it's a Acer Revo 3600.
Well, I have one of those.
Yeah,
that's the one I'm using in the bedroom for my HDPC in there.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've upgraded the RAM on it. The 4 gig, and I put Windows 7 Pro, upgraded that, and I have it hardwired into my network with a Cat 6, so I get pretty good performance with it. But you know, if you can't do anything really tough.
No, it's a pretty lightweight machine, but it does get by as an HDPC. Hey, let me ask you, mine tends to, the little fan tends to run pretty noisily. Every once in a while, it'll just go off and cool things back down again. And that's a pretty noisy little fan. It doesn't look like there's much you can do about it because, you know, you've taken it apart before, right? When you, I know
right.
You got it. And yeah, you can see that. Yeah, that fan is all part of like a heat sink fan assembly, and it's not like you can pull the fan off. Yeah, it's like a fan encased inside of this, I don't know, solid looking. It doesn't look like anything you could replace, although maybe that you could. But so what I wanted to ask you is if when you're using it, can you notice the fan going off and making noise in the background?
Not really. It's pretty quiet. You know, I have to really get down next to it to hear the fan.
Yeah, that's pretty interesting how the quality can be so different from machine to machine. So let me ask you this. Do you notice any stuttering with this at all? Any hesitations in the movie at all?
No, I haven't.
Okay.
I haven't caught anything.
You must have the dog version of the Revo 3600.
Do you have it hardwired?
Yeah.
You have a hardware that says.
Yeah.
But you get stuttering, Rich? Is that what you're saying?
It wasn't anything really enough to even get too worried about. Yeah. But yes, I did previously running off my version 1 server since I've gone to my RAID 5 setup in my Windows Home Server 2011. That seems to have gone away. I haven't
kind of stopped that. Yeah.
Yeah, I haven't seen it for a while.
So, you know, I was. Oh, go ahead, John. Sorry.
I was just saying, your stuttering's coming from the server then? Is that what you're...
Well, that's my assumption because, like I said, again, it really wasn't that often, but... And actually, now that I think about it, let me think. It's coming back to me a little bit. Actually, sometimes the movie would just up and halt. You know, it'd freeze up and stop. And since I've gone over to the 2011, it doesn't seem to be happening, so... You know, there's a lot of factors with the version 1 that can... alter your experience. I mean, you could be running add-ins. Maybe that DE Migrator service is running in the background.
Yeah.
You know that thing that the the disk balancing thing, utility running in the background, trying to split the data evenly across all your available hard drives in there, which some people, I don't know. I think I was drawn into that, but then after a while I thought, you know, this why is this running? You know, why do I care if all my data is on one drive or the other? Hey, Mike, how are you doing?
Hey, what's going on, guys?
Waiting for you to show up so we can start the show.
We were talking about, John and I were comparing our Revo, what was it, 3600?
3600, yeah.
Yeah, 3600 PCs. It's a little mini PCs that we're using for HTPC.
I'm in the process of building an HTPC. I've ordered my all the stuff's on order. I'm going to go with Sandy Bridge, an i3.
Are you going with the quiet i3 or like the 2100S or something like that, or are you just going with the standard?
Just the standard. You mean the low power?
Yeah.
The 2100S.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm going with the 2120. So, see what happens.
I think you'll be pleasantly surprised with that performance of the i3. Yeah, it's a good little chip, and I've, you know, I'm kind of running maybe it's first gen, so the Core i3 530, and that's kind of what's powering this all this media that's going out, and the thing just works, and it I have very few problems with it, and I watch the CPU utilization all the time. So I'm looking forward to the next PC I'll buy will probably be a Sandy Bridge Core i3. They're good little chips, so they just seem to work.
Has the show actually started?
It never really starts, Mike.
Okay, I was gonna say
waiting for you.
I was gonna say it sounds like somebody has a helicopter hovering in the background.
That's the little noise that we're getting from John's microphone there. So yeah. Just a little background noise. I was going to ask you a question, Mike.
I just got back from a 9/11 memorial service at our
city
hall where we unveiled a 1,700-pound piece of one of the World Trade Centers.
Really?
Yeah. We have a piece that we'll permanently have. We're going to put it on display there in the city hall area.
I guess that's one good way to get rid of or to disperse that building, right, is to give chunks of it away to various municipalities around the country and have them build memorials around it.
I think, haven't they also used some of it in the construction of battleships or something like that?
I think the steel that came off of that was recycled and went into some Navy.
Well, this is a chunk of the steel. This is one of the I-beams that was on the 101, 104, somewhere, I think the whole 101 through 104 floors that was in the area where the plane hit.
It's incredible to watch those pictures again. I mean, I haven't seen those things in a couple of years, and then they've been all over the web, and it's been interesting to see that again.
Yeah. And we had several guest speakers who were actually there, and it's also different to hear them speak in person than it is on TV.
Yeah. Yeah. Rich?
My cousin Chris was telling me that he and his family went to the top of the World Trade Center the day before.
Oh.
They were down visiting their sister, my cousin Peg. She has an apartment, and they have a direct line of sight. And the next morning, they were at breakfast, and my cousin Chris's son ran to the window when he heard the first explosion, looked out the window, and yelled over for them to come take a look. And they stood there, dumbfounded, as the next plane crashed in. So they actually saw it. And, I mean, it's crazy, you know, because they were just on the top of one of those buildings the day before.
Yeah, that's crazy. My brother-in-law was three blocks away, headed there for a meeting, and the person he was meeting was already there. It was on like the third floor, so that person got out okay too. But you know, he obviously did not continue on.
Yeah. Hey, let me ask this question. So it's been a decade. How do you think technology, if that hadn't happened, what do you think wouldn't have happened with technology? I've got something specific in mind, but you know, that changed the course of a lot of things. Do you think any new technologies came out of that, or there were technologies that were encouraged to grow because of that incident?
Yeah, I think, I don't know specifically, but I know they've vastly improved their communication with the emergency people because they had major communication problems that day. And I think whether that's just protocols or actual technology, that's one area. The other thing, if you remember when it hit the Pentagon, the reason it wasn't the same damage there that there was in trade towers is they had a special coating on the actual building. And if you ever seen that coating on like a concrete, on a cinder block wall, on what it can take versus a regular cinder block wall, I mean, it's some incredible stuff. And it's just a thin coating that's sprayed on it. Have you seen that?
No, and what is that?
So they showed an example of a cinder block wall, just, you know, no support, just straight up.
Sure.
And they set off a bomb in front of it, and a regular cinder block wall just exploded. They set the same bomb off in front of a cinder block wall that had this spray-on coating, and the cinder block wall just kind of gave a little bit and came back. It stayed intact. And the Pentagon already had that stuff sprayed on top of them. I think it's similar to what they spray in the beds of pickups.
Like a tough coat.
Yeah, I have to look it up and give you more details.
Yeah, I'm sure it's a polymer, right? It's some kind of polymer.
Wow, pretty amazing. So what did you have in mind, Jim?
Well, I want to see if anybody else has anything that before I say anything. You guys, John, think any other technologies that changed because of the World Trade Center?
I don't think something changed, but I think they really got down with the whole filtering of the phone systems and, you know, tapping of the phone systems and listening for keywords. You know, they got that whole voice recognition thing down.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I think I would agree with you. I think it's better. Well, it depends on how you define the word better, right? And that's maybe a...
Well, we're just talking about technology.
Right.
No, but let's not make the judgment here. Let's not stop this podcast.
We tried last week, but the for me, we've seen, of course, the advent of drone and avionics technology boom through that. I remember thinking back in the 90s and seeing that the technology that went around flying aircraft via remote control, and it was horrible. It was horrific. They were crashing those things all the time. And for whatever reason, the conditions were just right. And of course, if you look back in 2002 and 2003, they flew a handful of drones during combat missions there. Most combat missions now, and I, you know what, I'm not in the Defense Department, so I can't speak on behalf of them, and I don't have any statistics to back this up. But I do know there are a lot, most of the flights, a good number of them now, are being flown by drones. And that technology to send that information via, I imagine it's being done via satellite. It's really pulling a lot of pilots out of harm's way. And I think we'll, that technology will bleed directly into the private sector as we improve. You know, we've always had this idea that we could have aircraft that would fly cheaply, inexpensively, like cars, right? Flying cars. We've always thought we get to that point. I think the technology that you're going to see in drones at some point will be applied to smaller aircraft that move people around. And you don't necessarily then have to be a pilot to fly one of these things. Because today, if you want to do that, right, you got to be a pilot. You got to be a pilot and have a pilot's license. With the drone technology, I would think we would be able to maybe offload some of that to a pilot who sits in a control center somewhere. You just get in the car, they fly you to your destination, and maybe it doesn't have to be a big jet airliner that does it. I mean, if they
like a service, maybe even.
Yeah, exactly. So. Yeah. So I would go to my local airport and I would board a 6 or an 8 seater that would be flown via remote control. So a drone, those drones carry anywhere between a ton or two of ordnance when
they
fly.
Yeah, but are you going to get on that thing?
No way.
Yeah, right.
Mike, you're yeah, well, but are you
I'm saying, don't you want a live person? Yeah, don't
I want
you
the guy flying the thing to have the same thing at risk that I have at risk.
There you go.
Well, there is that point. There is that
That's
point.
Well put. That's about as well put as you can make it right there.
I do not want some guy, whether it's a teenage kid or
say
whatever.
Game over. Oh, well. LOL.
Yep. Whoops, lost that one.
Well, but what if – but hold on. So what if the – what if – it wasn't completely pilotless, right? But what if that the advancements that they've made in that technology makes that easier for the pilot to fly that thing, or safer for the pilot to fly that thing?
Now, what I wouldn't mind is not necessarily an override, but a safety. Like if the pilot were to have a heart attack and die, that somehow then, you know, control could be switched back over to the tower or something like that. If that's the case, or in a case of a terrorist situation like we had back in 9/11, if there could be some override. I'm a little worried about those overrides and whether they could be hacked, because you know everything can be hacked.
Right.
But you know, that in theory, if you could make it where it couldn't be, that would be something I would be interested in.
So it really would bother you to get in an automatic. What about an automatic car that you get in and you. You don't steer, but it drives itself via...
Same deal.
At highway speeds, yeah. I mean, if you were in town where you couldn't go very fast, maybe. But at highway speeds...
I think highway is safer for those kinds of technologies then. Because you're in town, you got to deal with traffic and people and lights and on the...
You know that nobody's going to let that happen without them being able to sit there and say, okay, well, wait a minute. I don't like what's happening here. I'm grabbing the wheel. I'm taking control of the, you know, brake and accelerator.
I don't know.
And if they can't let you smoothly take it over without a fist fight between you and the automatic computer control system, I don't think you're going to be able to sell it to people right off the bat. My opinion.
Yeah, no, I'm trying not to dominate it, but yeah, I guess I don't, Rich. I don't share that, and Mike, maybe as well. I don't share that level of where I have to have that kind of control, especially in a world where computers are faster. And I get the whole idea that there's got to be somebody on the ground, or you want them in the aircraft so that they have the same level of commitment that you have at the moment. I get that. But if as good as some of these, I would absolutely get in a drone, an Air Force drone, and be in that thing while somebody flies it from the ground. I absolutely would be.
Now, what are you going to address what Mike was saying in so many words? What are you going to do about somebody hacking your system unbeknownst to you? You know, hacking your car system, maybe doing something to your brakes. Like after 100 miles, you know, flip the inverter on this output, and next thing you know, stepping on your brakes doesn't work anymore or whatever.
Well, but, I mean, people could tamper with my vehicle today, and I don't necessarily
No, but they can't
about.
Tamper with it electronically. They can't sit there and mess with it.
My Honda has a pretty sophisticated computer in it that could be tapped into, and things could be changed in it, right? I mean, the answer to your question there is I don't worry about it for the same reason I don't worry about somebody necessarily, or I don't stay up at night thinking about someone hacking into my computer, because I have some safeguards in place that I feel, one, that I feel like I'm pretty confident they're not going to get through because I'm a nobody. And nobody's going to mess with me because I'm a nobody. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I suppose.
Who wants my stuff?
I use that argument.
They're going to, maybe they're going to use you as a test case.
Well, thanks, John. Appreciate that. John, you've got some experience in the power grid, I assume. And, of course, we're always in the advent of or after 9/11, we were worried about terrorists getting into our power grid. Has that really become a reality? I don't. Doesn't seem like it.
A lot of people are worried about it.
Right.
NERC continues to issue alerts on it, and utilities. I'm trying to think about how much I can talk about.
Yeah. Well, don't give away any secrets.
This is going all over the internet.
You and about 14 other people are going to listen to it.
maybe 15 if they're really.
That's right. 15 if you tell your mom or your sister. Don't give away secrets.
So there are a lot of issues out there, but you could go to the NERC website and look at the alerts and just get a feel for the things that they're looking at.
Just a sec. Andrew, mute your line there for me.
It's his way of introducing himself.
I know. He never mutes it when he comes in.
He leaves his headset on the desk, then he picks it up, slam, slam, slam.
Andrew's here.
are you getting a lot of noise off of my head?
All right. We're going to see if we can give Jay a second to introduce himself. We gave John the chance to do that. So, tell us who you are and then kind of your technology background and maybe what you specialize in from a technology standpoint.
Sure. Well, my name is Jay. Gosh, I don't know. I've been with technology for a long time. I worked on some Unix 3v2 system in the Air Force. And I got out and worked help desk for PCs. And now I'm just kind of I'm a system administrator at TriWest Healthcare, which manages the military healthcare system for the west side of the United States. So, you know, so I'm giving back to those who serve. At least I feel that way anyway. So that's
very nice.
You know,
very nice. Yeah. Well, welcome. Glad you've come out to join us, and you can see we don't have a format. We just sit around and talk about whatever we want.
Right, which is why I absolutely love this one, probably the best, because, you know, it's random, which is great.
It's just whatever comes up, so I appreciate it. Well, I was asking John if there had been, or if we're as concerned as we need to be about the power grid, and all stemmed around this idea of trust. So, John, did you have any further thoughts on that?
You had asked about security issues with power systems, and it's when I first started out at utilities, protection systems were all electrical and mechanical. I started out as a test engineer, and we would go out, and it would take lots of time to set that equipment to protect the system. Now they've advanced to more solid-state systems that in a single device, you can have multiple protection schemes, like in a substation. And the thing is, too, these devices, you can remote into them, and it makes it a lot more efficient. They test themselves and stuff, and so there's a lot of advantages to it. But the disadvantage is if somebody were to figure out how to remote into those things, you could really play havoc. And, I mean, you saw what happened in California just recently. That's probably more of a maintenance issue, just not maintaining the relays and the equipment that they have. And,
no, tell us what happened in California.
Well, they had, you know, the outage in Southern California a couple of days ago.
Okay. All right.
And it had the initiation actually at a substation in Arizona, and an employee was testing some equipment, and he took a device out. Well, there should have been backups that would have prevented any kind of cascading event, but the backups, those failed, the backups to the backups failed. More and more things kept failing, and so you had a cascading event that eventually took out Southern California. I mean, this is all.
And for how long?
It was about a day.
Oh,
well, it started. Wow. It started at what? About 3:30 on Thursday.
Right.
It took out San Diego, southern part of California. Hey, is that where you're at, Jay? Or
no, I'm in Phoenix. But
oh, okay.
Yeah.
So you're close.
Right. 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 Yeah, that was in Yuma. Was where I went down, right?
You're right, yeah.
So
yeah. And, I mean, yeah, one of the things that they use to protect themselves are under-frequency-type relays that detect, I mean, as you lose generation or you lose connections, and if you have less power being generated than you have load, what will happen is the frequency of your generators that are operating will start to slow down because they're giving up energy from the momentum of their rotor into the system. Well, you have relays that detect that. When that happens, you're supposed to start dropping load to compensate for your lack of enough generation. And apparently they didn't operate correctly until the frequency dropped low enough that San Onofre, which is kind of north of San Diego, it's near San Clemente, they had to dump the station to prevent the low frequency from damaging the units. So that just was a contributing factor. And that was all just accident. Somebody could get into those relays and stuff. And
so let me ask you, what was that? Was it just a misconfiguration, or was it a failure of the parts themselves?
Well, there's going to be an investigation and all this sort of stuff.
Okay.
So who knows? But there were multiple systems that failed. And it's you know, as things get more and more complicated, you set yourself up for more problems. We find that ourselves when we're trying to build stuff and integrate it into our own little home network. You know, just imagine the complexity of a system that spans states or cross country or something.
Yeah. Hey, just to go back a second, you talked about remote access to these stations and to these systems, and that everybody is probably thinking right now, yeah, that is the most vulnerable point. How do they harden something like that?
Oh, they create layers and layers of defense against that.
Okay. So yeah, I guess that's about all you could say about it.
Yeah.
Without giving anything away.
Could tell you, but he'd have to kill you, Rich.
Oh, well, then don't tell me.
Yeah, they're tracking him down right now.
Yes, why is he asking these questions anyway? Who is this guy up in Maine? He says he's from Maine, but is he really?
So, yeah, got off onto that tangent, but I don't know if it's too exciting.
Well, we were talking about flying cars. That's how that started, by the way.
Well, that would make me nervous too. I like Mike's position was you want somebody up there that's got as much invested in that vehicle that's flying as you do.
Yeah, and I don't know if that's necessary. At least for me, I don't know if that's necessarily true. And so for Jay and Andrew, what we were talking about is I was talking about the drone technology over the last 10 years. We were talking about what technologies have improved because of 9/11. So that goes all the way back to the beginning of the discussion. And I thought it would be plausible at this point, because the drone technology is so good on the aircraft that they're flying from all over the world, and some guy's flying that in a bunker, right, that they can't get to, that I might even be comfortable enough to board one of those things without having a pilot.
Really? We'll let you take the initial test flight.
Yeah, let us know how that goes for you, Jim.
Thanks for caring about me, guys. Just
can I get the Drobo?
Totally, but we'll stand back and watch.
Yeah, hey, I don't,
Jim, can you put your Drobo in one of those IO safe things?
I already asked for the Drobo.
Yeah, Rich, I've already willed the Drobo to Rich.
Thank you.
Just so you know. Yeah. But
the vultures are circling, Jim.
They are. And it's just funny that the Drobo is the first thing mentioned.
I wondered how I got cut out of everything. I was going to get this WebOS tablet and all this stuff, and now I don't get anything.
Well, Mike, I leave you my Palm Pre there. Oh, it runs the WebOS.
What am I going to use that for?
It's kind of like a tablet. Jay, are you a Palm Pre fan?
No. No.
You were doing this, and I thought
he's going to reach for one.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's here somewhere. It's, yeah. Gosh, it's old, right?
I was going to say, do you want a couple of minutes to think about that?
Yeah. It's a WebOS device. It still works. I pull mine out from time to time and make it work. But
yes. Oh, here it is. Yes, my wife still uses a. Here it is. Here's her Palm. Palm Pre.
Yeah. Is it a 2? Palm Pre 2 or the original?
I think it's a 2. I don't know her pin, right?
Hold that up, Jay. Hold it up to the camera there.
It's a secret pin.
Let's see. The screen's too small. I need you to talk while you hold it up. Say something.
There. Sorry about that. Is that better? No, not really.
No.
It's hard to see.
Yeah, I think it's an original.
I think it is, yeah. I was actually thinking about the Palm 3X, if you remember those back, 15 years ago, 10 years ago?
Yeah. I might even have one around here.
Here's a compact PC.
I'll remember these. Put that away. Yeah. We threw heaps of them.
I remember those.
It's an iPack.
Yeah. Do you remember the specs on that thing?
Yes, crappy.
I think it's a 400 thereabouts megahertz RISC processor, isn't it?
Running Windows Compact or Compact? No. What do they call it? CE.
Yeah, CE.
Yeah, they were the first ones to have a Bluetooth stack in them.
I know the next technology Jay needs to invest in.
What's that?
A trash can.
I have one of those. I do have this Drobo and an IO safe and the Media Smart server. I mean, it's all because of you guys.
All right. If you guys didn't know, Jay was the winner of the first Drobo that we gave away on the Home Server Show.
Awesome. Awesome.
Yeah. Oh, cool.
My first thing to ever win, I promise.
I'll say that out loud.
Okay.
Jay, what have you got loaded in the Drobo?
Gosh, I've taken all of my movies. So I've robocopied everything from my Media Smart server over to it, if that's what you're talking about.
No, yes, that's a good answer. But what drives? I was interested in what size hard drives you have in there.
Right. I have three 1 terabyte West Mitchell Greens. Here, I'll just...
Let me just grab one for you.
Yank one out. The Drobo can handle it.
Uh-oh. Maybe he turned off his computer.
Do a live demonstration.
Your video froze up, Jay.
See, the machines are coming alive. The Drobo has killed the feed.
Andrew, was that an attempt at the Google sound?
No, that was just everything spinning down.
Oh, we lost Jay. Shoot.
I think the Drobo couldn't handle pulling out the drive.
I hear it.
The Drobo's revolting. Man.
Yeah. Jay's back.
That was weird. Sorry about that.
That's all right. So
I know how to replicate that now. Let's have a go at this.
Oh, yes.
So, anyway, Jay, you were saying, what do you have in your Drobo?
Yes, I have 3 1-terabyte West Digital Green Drives, like this one. Three of those.
Yeah, that's it. Just three and a four. It's a 4-bay, right?
Oh, yes. Sorry, I have a 751 in there as well. I think I'm going to pull it out. I think it's a
Samsung. You don't have to.
No, that's all right. Well, I want to check. Yes. Oh, it's a Seagate 750. There you go.
All right.
Cool.
And has that worked well for you from a storage standpoint?
Yes, absolutely. I think one of the biggest issues was when I was swapping out drives, the estimated time to resync everything was something like 64 hours. And so it took less time. Yeah, it was crazy. So I just deleted everything and then just recopied everything over. It was a lot faster. So
let's clarify on that real quick here. So when you say you were swapping out drives, what do you mean by that?
Right. So I had two 750s and two 1 terabyte drives in there. And so I pulled one of the 750s out and slapped in another 1 terabyte one. And so when it was doing its sync and stuff, you know, it said time to finish something like 64 hours.
Okay.
So.
Ouch. Okay.
Yeah, it's not one of the speediest things at all times, especially that USB 2
right.
configuration.
Oh, yeah, but it's still cool.
That was Jim Collison speaking, one of the greatest apologists for Robo ever.
Hey, I'm trying to be fair about this. That's all.
Wow. I think I need to do an evaluation of one in Australia to make sure they actually work in the Southern Hemisphere.
You should.
I think they work backwards. I think they work backwards.
Yeah, the platters spin backwards.
They do. That's right. That's a fact.
They do. I mentioned early in the show, but I'll tell you guys. So October 3rd, that's a Monday, I actually have an appointment at Drobo headquarters in San Jose, California. I'm going to be out there for a little bit of work. We're going to do some live blogging and podcasting from Drobo headquarters, and I get to meet some of the engineers as well as – I don't think they manufacture them right there, so I don't think I get to see that process, but get to talk to some of those guys at Drobo, so I'm pretty excited about that.
Is this part of your day job work, or is this something for the show?
Yeah, it's more show-related. So I'm going to be out in the Bay Area for work over the weekend.
Okay.
And I contacted Mario and said, hey, I'm going to be in town. Could we get together on Monday? And he was like, yeah, we'll do all this stuff with you. So it was kind of fun to have that work out from a timing perspective. I grew up probably, and this is probably why I like Drobo so much, is I grew up just miles from where their headquarters are. And no,
so
I don't work.
Why did you go to Nebraska?
Well, I was traveling across the country on wagon, and the wagon wheel broke. And so we just stayed here. No, we had family. We had family in Nebraska. California, when I got out of the military, was way too expensive to try and stay in.
Yeah.
Especially starting a new job. And so we had family that said, hey, move to Nebraska. And it was a great decision. So we've been out here 20 years, and I now podcast out of my basement. Just saying.
So,
Rich, bail me out with a question. Oh no, go ahead, John.
I have a question. When you go to Drobo on the 3rd, are you going to be able to when you do your live podcast, show us all the different types of equipment and kind of play with it live?
I don't know.
Like
I haven't. I just talked to Mario about it. I made the arrangements on Thursday, and he and I chatted on Friday, and so we're still kind of planning what's going to come out of it. So I'll keep you guys posted what comes up. And no, Rennie says in chat that I'm angling for the head PR job. Mario has that wrapped up nicely, so I doubt.
I've just invited Rennie into the chat, too, if he's got a camera and a headset.
Yeah, that'd be good. It's good to bring him in. Another fellow Australian in chat.
That's right. Yeah, we need. I need some moral support here. Actually, that... Talking back about Jay with his collection of old stuff, the link I just threw into the chat before, junkbox.org, that's an online service where you can give away all your crap.
Very good. Thanks.
The free market for electronics, they call themselves.
Oh, look at that, yeah.
Huh. Some of the stuff they've got there is unreal.
Rich, you got a question for us?
I have a question for you, yeah.
Fire away.
Who here is using Macs? Because I've been looking at these things for a while. I'm trying to decide, do I want to buy a Mac Mini? The price is better. You know, it's in the acceptable range. Or do I want to jump up and actually buy a MacBook Pro?
You want neither, Rich.
Do I need it? Well, see, I'm asking my girlfriend, and she keeps telling me no, but
I think you need one of each, Rich.
I do.
I think you need neither.
Okay.
Explain, Mike.
No, we don't need to hear why Mike says that.
For the simple reason it's a Mac.
Because I hate Mac is why.
Well, Mike, do you hate Mac more or Skype more?
At this moment, I hate Skype.
That's a great question.
All right, now who is actually using a Mac here? Anybody? Tell me why I should spend some money on a Mac. Give me a couple of good reasons. I'm not going to pick you apart on this. I'm just looking for a good excuse. So whatever you say is fine.
Can you hook it to a Dremel?
Yes, you can.
Yep.
There you go.
You can even hook it up to a 2011 home server if you don't upgrade to Lion.
So, Rich, you're a musician. The software, the GarageBand, the software for that is probably better on the Mac than it is on the PC.
Okay.
So,
and what else? Give me something else.
I think for a newbie, they're great because their service at the Mac stores, the training that they do and everything, they hold your hand a lot more.
Yeah.
And for somebody like my sister, she has a Mac, and she was able to go when she got her Mac, and she'd gotten an iPad and all the other stuff there. She signed up for courses at the Mac store, and she went there and they showed her how to use it. She's using it to get her master's in nursing.
And do you have a Mac yourself?
No, I do not.
What you just said, though, that's very cool. That's one thing that I've noticed about, if you don't know anything about GarageBand, hey, this Thursday at 10 o'clock, we're doing a seminar on it, and we're going to do one again next Monday. So, yeah, they are all over the training and getting people familiar with their computer and their software. It is pretty impressive. The customer service thing is pretty impressive. Beats the living daylights out of Microsoft, I got to say that.
Well, but Rich, that scales a little bit differently, right? I mean, the PC user or the Microsoft users still way outnumber the Mac users. So that just scales differently.
Mm. Although there was a bit of scuttlebutt going around the traps that Apple may have been a purchaser for the HP Personal Systems Group. So if that had happened, that may have changed the HP Enterprise Services. So that would have changed the landscape a bit.
In what way, Andrew?
Oh, there was a lot of talk going around a couple of weeks ago that the division of HP I work for may have been a prime candidate, and Apple was rumored as being one of the potential candidates to pick them up.
From an enterprise standpoint?
Yeah, that would have put the cat amongst the pigeons for sure.
Yeah,
is that still rumor still going around?
Nah, it got squashed by Apple.
Yeah, that isn't. I think Oracle's going to buy HP before. something like that happens.
Yeah, that's just to settle a grudge, though.
Well, certainly Mark Hurd would buy HP and then fire every senior executive that fired him, right?
Pretty much.
That's how that would work.
That brings up a point where Apple's eventually going to have to do something with that cash, at least some of it, or else shareholders need to start revolting and say, you need to dividend some of that cash. That cash, I imagine they're in the same boat as everybody else with cash, is that they're earning squat on the cash. And you need to either, you're a public company now, and you either have a plan for that cash or you dividend it to the owners, the shareholders.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because what are they worth now? They've just passed $390 billion or something, haven't they?
In cash?
No, that's a total net worth, I believe.
Yeah, total net worth, yeah. I mean, either way you look at it, that's still a heck of a lot of money.
Yeah,
the cash position, I forgot, but I thought it was something like $70 billion or somewhere in that range. It's pretty high up there.
Yeah. Well, back to Rich's question, because I think it's a good one. I'm going to come out and say I don't know if there's that much difference, to be honest with you, for the average user between Mac OS and Microsoft Windows OS at this point. I mean, I use both, and they especially when you're in the browser – There's really almost no difference between the two. Now, I run into some problems with things like DirectX or Silverlight or what else would I have problems
with? Okay, that's a good question for you then. How is Netflix streaming on a Mac?
I haven't done that, Rich. I'll be honest with you. I'll have to bow out on that one.
You're still running 10.5, aren't you, Jim?
I am. I'm a G4 guy that, you know, that's still – it's a PowerPC chip, and I'm still on
Actually, you're the perfect guy to answer this question. So you're running a G4. Should I just go ahead and maybe buy an older –
Well, I wouldn't buy this one, Rich, to be honest with you. Right, I would buy the next – if I was going to go older – Well, you can buy mine if you want. It's like $1,000.
No, everything's for sale, right, Jim?
I get that. I can get a new one for $1,000. Thanks for the offer, though.
Darn it! I would go the very next unit up was Intel. So if you're going to go with an older Mac and do it that way, make sure you're getting
the Core 2.
Yeah, because you can't. I can't upgrade beyond Leopard, so I'm stuck on Leopard at this point. Right. And Snow Leopard, of course, Snow Leopard and then Lion have come out since, and it would be nice to run those newer OSs, and I can't.
And what does Lion give you over Snow Leopard? You know, this is probably the wrong question for this group of guys.
It really is. I don't know enough. I'll be honest, I don't know That's enough okay. about it to speak to it.
That's I'm okay. starting to wonder why I'm here.
No, Mike, stay. Oh, don't God. Ditch us. Well, but Mike,
I think it's like everything.
Go ahead, Andrew.
I think it's like anything. The Mac versus PC argument. There's a market for any operating system. It's kind of like saying who uses Linux. Yeah, you know, there are definitely people out there who it suits them down to the ground because they don't want to be another Microsoft sheep. I mean, I sort of try to slide across to Linux. I'm a bit like you, Jim. I desperately want Ubuntu or Red Hat or one of them to be successful. And I think the more that they release their variations of it and fragment their user community, I think that's where they struggle. Whereas the point of difference between Windows and OS X is getting smaller because the look and feel remains the same as they go through the various iterations.
Windows 7 did make a big jump as far as the UI goes, getting closer to the Mac.
Yeah, and I think Windows 8 is going to get it even closer.
Yeah,
from what I've seen so far.
Yeah. A lot of people crabbing and moaning about the whole tile thing, but. I really don't know why they're complaining about it because, to my understanding, you can just say, hey, you know what? I don't just prefer this. Yeah, flip it off. And not flip it off.
Nice.
No, not flip it off.
That's going to make the outtakes.
We can switch over.
It's almost as good as the outtake from the home
show. I never mentioned Mac. He is totally wound up. Mike is totally wound up now. But you can just turn that right off, and you can just go back to your Windows 7 UI and still have any features that 8 would bring in. So.
And they're going to build Hyper-V into Windows 8, which is going to be a big plus.
That's going to be interesting. Do you think they'll get that in the home version too, or is that going to be only in the Pro?
I don't know, because you know the virtual XP was only in the Pro version, wasn't it?
Yeah,
so I can. They've already set a standard for, so it probably will not be in the home version. But who knows? I don't know.
Never stops you running something like VirtualBox or VMware Workstation anyway.
Right. And you know the one thing I'd be interested to see is this Hyper-V going to have the same limitations as the current Hyper-V? You know, you can't pass USB over. I don't think you can pass USB over.
You know, you can in the bare metal one. Yeah.
You can in the bare metal because I used the one with 2008 R2, and you can't pass USB over.
Mike, what does that mean when you say that? USB?
For instance, I made the mistake of setting up my Windows Home Server 2011 as a VM on my Windows 2008 R2 Hyper-V server. And my son screwed up his computer, and I wanted to do a restore. So I was going to use the USB stick and do that method where you can, do a USB stick on Windows 2011. And I could not get Windows 2011 to see the USB stick. I could not pass that hardware through Hyper-V to the VM. And that's where I decided I'm not going to virtualize Windows Home Server 2011.
So is that like a camera? It won't recognize the camera as a camera? for that, for the virtualization process?
I don't think so. I didn't try a camera, but I would imagine that would work just like the USB stick. It wouldn't see it.
Mm.
And it doesn't not, it just doesn't recognize it as hardware, and so it doesn't show up as available to the OS? Is that what you mean?
I didn't even see where in Hyper-V to even pass it through. Since it's a VM, and you have to do in the settings somewhere, give it access to that, right?
Okay. I mean, I have not used Hyper-V, and I've used Oracle's VirtualBox to date, and that has a really nice, I would take external storage, plug it in via USB, and then in there I would select, create a new virtual hard drive, a virtual, SATA drive, so to speak, and then it would say, well, where's that drive exist? And I would point it, now this is on top of Windows 7, so it's Oracle VirtualBox on top of Windows 7. Where does that exist? And I just point it to that drive, and it would put a file on that hard drive, and away I went. So it won't do that with Hyper-V, on what you're saying?
No, and I don't know if Hyper-V and VirtualBox are the same type of virtualization. I think, Hyper-V obviously has the bare metal version, and maybe the version I'm using, which is part of 2008 R2, is similar to VirtualBox. I don't know. They both need, in that case, they both need a guest OS. On my computer, I actually will run VirtualBox. I have Ubuntu, like Andrew had mentioned earlier. I run several different Linux variations on there, and those you can pass USB through, no problem. But I have not got it to pass through on Hyper-V. You know, you're going to think that I'm not a Microsoft fan, but I am. I just think that
And you love Excel.
I do love Excel. Hyper-V is, Hyper-V is...
He's got an accountant,
Hyper-V has some growing
anybody
to do.
Anybody that doesn't know. So regular Windows Virtual PC, the one that comes with XP mode in Windows 7 Professional, that passes USB fine, right? Is that what we're talking about? And it's just easy. You just reach up to the top and click the little tab and it says... hey, do you want to attach this or release this device? You say attach it, and bang, now you have access to your USB drive or whatever.
And VirtualBox is very easy to do that also.
Yeah, I've loved VirtualBox. It's been a fabulous product for those reasons. And it's light, it's easy, it works. Everything I've tried, except I did have some audio issues with it because I was going to create some virtual machine to be like the broadcaster PC, Mike, and you'll understand what I'm talking about when I say broadcaster PC for what we do. It's just a second PC that sends the signal out so folks can watch it. And it struggled, at least on the settings, on the sound settings, to have two boxes sharing the same sound card, if that makes sense. So my underlying OS was using the sound card and the VM was using the sound card. It struggled with that.
I just counted. I have 20 VMs in VirtualBox right now.
Wow.
I got everything from, I don't even know how you pronounce this, HAIKU operating system. Haku operating system to, Windows 2008 R2 variation.
What's that Haku one do?
It's crap.
That was like a... That was like a spin-off of BIOS or something, wasn't it?
Yeah, I got...
Now, Mike, why?
When VirtualBox is so awesome and so easy to use, I said, I want to try a lot of different operating systems that I would not actually set up a dual boot or do something like that, but I could do them easily here. So I got React OS, Mint OS, Haku, however you say, FreeBSD. I have a DOS. All those things. And then the ones I really use, I have a Ubuntu, a PinGuy Linux, and a Windows 7 variation that I use.
What did you think of the PinGuy?
I like that one. That one's nice.
Yeah. Set up a multimedia pretty nicely.
Yeah.
All the codecs.
What's it called?
PinGuy, PINGUY, Linux. I think it's an offshoot of Ubuntu.
Okay.
I think you're right.
Yeah, because I ditched Ubuntu when they changed the user interface to Unity because the interface is just horrendous.
I think, Jim, you were telling me that you were having trouble with it capturing the mouse on the keyboard and you had to do the Alt-L or whatever it was to get it out. What you have to do is add guest editions, and then it won't capture that. Then it is seamless between the two.
Okay, so what do you mean by that? Add guest editions.
Now, if it's a Windows OS, it's super easy. You just, when you have the thing running, you go to one of the VirtualBox controls, machine or file, whatever it is, I can't remember, and you load guest editions as a CD.
Oh, okay.
Your OS will see it. You load those guest editions, and now you can work in what's called seamless mode, to where you could make it to where it just blends in totally into the background, and you don't even realize it's there. And no. So you'll get confused as to which OS you're even in. It can be so seamless.
Okay. I'll have to give that a try. I haven't messed with that as much. I'm running my 2011 boxes on it right now that I'm testing the drive extenders on.
Yeah.
One of the really nice features that I've liked in the newest version, so it's 4.1, is the cloning technology that they have to clone those. Is really a right click and clone now.
Yeah.
And it just works. And so I created a base image of Windows 2011 or Windows Home Server 2011, got it patched, you know, everything up to date just the way I wanted it. I didn't install anything on it, but I got the hard drive configurations the way I wanted them. And then I just hit clone, renamed it Windows Home Server 2011 Stable Bit, because I'm going to test Stable Bit on it, and then just let it run. And I came back an hour later, and it was there, and I clicked it, and it started up, and it was just like the one I'd done before. So yeah. I think for the average tech guy, VirtualBox is the way to go.
It is. It's so easy. Now, with a Linux OS, installing the guest editions is a little bit more involved. You have to follow an online guide.
With the base, with it as the guest or as the host?
As a guest. So okay. If you're running Windows 7 like I am, and you want to put PinGuy Linux or Ubuntu or Fedora or whatever it is, and you want to install in guest editions to it, it's a little bit more involved. I guess if you're familiar with using Linux, then it would be pretty easy. But for me, I got to look it up every time I do it.
Let me ask you something here. You're talking about Hyper-V, yes. And then you're talking about something like Virtual PC or something similar to that, or VirtualBox. What is the big difference, or what are some of the big features about Hyper-V, why somebody would want that over something like a VirtualBox?
Well, I think it somewhat depends on what you're doing there, because a VirtualBox requires a guest OS, a host OS, I'm sorry. And Hyper-V can work as a bare metal, where it is the base OS and then all the VMs install on top of that. So in that sense, they're different. If you're looking at like a Windows 2008 R2 Hyper-V, then I think it's similar.
How does that translate? Is that like a speed bump? I mean, better performance with the Hyper-V?
That's a good question. I don't know. I haven't heard too many comparisons between VirtualBox and Hyper-V. Is more like Hyper-V, Zen Server, and VMware's
ASX.
Virtual Server. Yeah. Yeah, those are the ones I see compared. I don't often see VirtualBox compared to that.
There's some enterprise, you know, it's enterprise grade versus VirtualBox kind of coming out of an open source. You know, VirtualBox is a Sun tool. I think even a Skunkworks tool, it's Sun when it first started. That has grown, and of course Oracle has taken it and surprisingly has not killed it, which I thought they would, but has improved it. And so Oracle continues to surprise me, if we want to talk enterprise for just a second. Oracle's continued to surprise me that they brought Sun on and didn't kill the hardware. We thought they'd spin the hardware off, and they have made that a part of their – they have both Exadata and Exalogic servers now that are built completely on Sun hardware that support database and applications environment. But then specifically, they've begun to improve this VirtualBox. And of course, Oracle wants to be in that virtual space. You know, I imagine that VirtualBox will eventually blend in with some of the other virtualization technologies that they're using. But for the home user, it's just dynamite. I don't know. Let me ask the new guys, you know, John or Jay, have you guys experimented much with virtualization? You've been kind of quiet through this discussion.
Well, that's actually part of my job. So, okay. Yeah, we are an ESX shop. So, oh, I'm green too. That's weird.
That's funky.
Yeah.
That's all right. Keep going. Yes.
Yeah. So, we first got into virtualization about 3.5-4 years ago with Microsoft's Virtual Server, if you remember that. And the problem that we had was the host that it was on one day needed patches and updates. So that, of course,
that's
oh yeah. So that rebooted all of the VMs, and people went nuts. because, you know, it just shut them down. So my boss walked over to my desk and he said, what's this new ESX stuff that I've been hearing about? And, you know, I mean, we started off with a three-blade pilot, and now we're up to, 25 hosts now in four different clusters. So the whole VMware Kool-Aid has been drunk many, many times.
Mm. Yeah. And it makes things incredibly easy too, doesn't it? Especially when you start running vMotion, so that your resources start managing themselves between your physical hypervisor layers and the like.
Sure,
that's the absolutely. Thing for mine. You know, you want to shut a box down, you just say, I'm going to shut it down, and everything gets moved, and you shut it down, and it comes back up, and move it all back. I reckon that's magic to me.
Right. Yeah. Patching a host is nothing more than just putting it into maintenance mode, and that moves about 25 to 35 VMs over to another host, and then, you know, we just patch it all day long. So it's great stuff. Very expensive, though. Very, very expensive. I mean, even at VMworld, which is VMware's huge, let's see, last week there was 19,000 people there. Yeah, that was in Vegas. There's a little tiny booth from Microsoft. So, you know, they're off in the corner somewhere. So that's always fun to, you know, talk to them.
Expensive, Jay, from a licensing standpoint, hardware standpoint, or both?
It's all licensing. It gets very expensive. When you start getting up into the HA, which is high availability, all right, so what that does is that, say you've got a host that's got 20 VMs on it or whatever, and someone pulls the plug or pulls a network cable. So that host is going to talk to everything else, the virtual center, and restart all those VMs on different hosts. So it definitely tends to get expensive. I don't have numbers in front of me, but, you know.
Yeah, what we see is that for the layperson, you know, if you want to run up an ESX box at home, ESX itself is free. It's when you want to start managing it through an interface and a GUI, and, you know, start doing the funky stuff like automatic management of resources and things like that. That's when you start getting expensive too. For the layperson also, they've got a product called GSX. Is it still called GSX, Joe? And GSX runs on top of, or VMware Server it's called now, isn't it?
Yes, it is called. Yes, hang on. Yes.
And that runs on top of your normal Windows server platform.
Right. But then you still have the same problem with, if your host needs to be patched, well, then you got to shut all of down, you know, all the VMs.
Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly. But it's an alternative to a virtual box if you're running a, say, Windows Home Server 2011 or something like that. It sits quite nicely on top of it.
Absolutely.
Now, I run both Hyper-V and Zen Server here at the house. And some things I like about each one of them, you know, Hyper-V just added the dynamic memory. But I think it's not nearly as good as what Zen Server has in their paid version or VM has in their version either. Their dynamic memory requires a special OS and special, you got to upload the new guest editions, and you've got to have the Service Pack 1 running. And even then, it doesn't work on everything.
I think one of the benefits of ESX is because the enterprise has adopted it so much, pretty much everything runs on top of it now.
Right. Absolutely.
I think about the only thing we've found that won't run on top of it is VMS.
Which is what?
VMS.
Yeah.
So your true hardcore mid-range platform.
Okay. Yeah, you know, guys, we're dangerously close to an enterprise podcast here.
I was just going to say I'm at the very bottom of the learning curve on virtual machines. The reason I got the laptop that I did was I was looking for a dual core that supported virtualization. And so I got it. I loaded the 7 Pro on it. And then when I went to Microsoft's website and pulled down the virtual, it wouldn't load. And investigating further, I found out Acer didn't have the enableization in the BIOS. I couldn't even go into the BIOS and turn it on. So I really had to wait until I got the X58 before I could start playing with it. And so I've loaded, like I said, Windows XP Pro. And I used that. I had some legacy programs that wouldn't run in Windows 7, so I used that. But just for fun, I loaded Windows Home Server version 1, and I played with that. But that's I'm down the road, I'm looking at wanting to have a 2008 and R2 and trying some different virtualization. I'm still pretty far down the learning curve.
Yeah, there's plenty of good resources out there, and always feel free to drop any of us a line, I reckon.
Yeah, I learned a lot at the meetup up in Wisconsin and picked up a lot of things up there. And there's actually a lot of, I joined TechNet, and there's a lot of courses in TechNet. I haven't tried those yet, but I see a lot in there that I'm planning to give a shot when I get some time.
Yeah, have a look with your TechNet subscription. A lot of them you can get access to the Microsoft Virtual Academy using a TechNet subscription, and that's really handy. That one you can there's a whole bunch of like online courses. I'm just trying to find the link for it. MicrosoftVirtualAcademy.com, and they've got heaps and heaps of online courses. And I'm not sure. I think it's linked to a TechNet subscription.
One of the things I'm debating is rebuilding my personal PC with SSD and the data drive being RAID 0 Caviar Blacks, which I have right now. But then when I start load, I'm either going to transfer the system over as is or rebuild completely. And then if I rebuild completely, thinking about whether I want a lot of my secondary programs to just load them into a VM and not run them onto the regular system. How do you guys handle when you go to upgrade your hardware? Do you reinstall brand new? Or what do you think about loading it onto a VM?
From my perspective, Mike, it depends what hardware you can pass through. For me, I need to be able to pass through a webcam. I need to be able to pass through audio, all the things that you use on a day-to-day basis. And I don't necessarily want a hypervisor slowing me down. That's for me. Mm-hmm. But then you got the benefit of if you upgrade your hardware underneath, you can just shift it across because you become hardware agnostic once you virtualize.
Right. And that's part of my thinking is the things like, for me, it'd be Lightroom, Photoshop, the video editing, that kind of stuff you have on your main PC. The things that aren't nearly as important as far as resources go, like let me Quicken or some of the other things like that, you put them on to into a VM. And run them, maybe even on a second machine. I don't know. It's going to be very interesting when they come out with Windows 8 and have Hyper-V in there, and give us more options. Because I hate upgrading after you've personalized your system as much as like I have, and losing all that if I do a fresh upgrade, fresh install.
Yeah, well, I guess if you've got a Windows Home server, you could do the upgrade the Christian Johnson style and back it up, change over your hardware and restore it back, having removed all your driver stack. Because Christian spoke about that early on in the Home Tech show, where he removed all the driver stack off his Windows 7 machine, backed it up, restored it onto new hardware, and then let it detect everything again, which I guess is one of the benefits of using that technology.
There's about 8 different conversations going on at the same time.
I can hear everybody typing.
That's why it's so quiet, because everybody's typing. There's conversations going back and forth. And
I don't mean to hog the conversation. I kept pausing, letting somebody else talk, and nobody would say anything.
No, I'm just watching everybody's typing. That's hilarious. So it's too
you guys
bad.
Jump in whenever.
It's too bad you can't capture all the chat that we have going on. While you guys are talking, I also have Jerry Wade, who's the home server status guy. I just wrote the home server status data, and he was pinging me as well. So I'm like, too much input. Nice.
Trying to fill some dead space, too.
Yeah, well, anyways. Rich.
Don't worry about that. By the time we get done editing, this podcast will be whittled down to 20 minutes anyway.
Good on you, Rich.
That's good.
I guess while we're
talking new systems, I finally got my hands on one of those ProLiant microservers yesterday and built it up as a 2011 box. So I one of my friends has just shelled out nearly $3,000 on a clean room recovery of a hard disk. So I've convinced him that I've convinced him that a home server is kind of necessary to future-proof his business data.
Oh, yeah.
So ended up going with a RAID 1 of 2 2-terabyte Western Digital Enterprise disks using the fake RAID that they have built onto the chipset in 2011. Just an hour and a half later, it was all up and going, fully supported out of the box.
How's the speed on that ProLiant? I wonder about the CPU not being hefty enough.
I think for serving data, it's okay. I don't know that I'd... One of my friends runs one as a workstation, and I think he said the performance rating's about 3.8, which is in line with a Pentium D3 gigahertz.
And, you know, Dave threw that link in the Home Server Show forums for, I think it's down as cheap as about 304 here in the U.S.
Right.
Yeah, okay.
And John, I have the same concerns. I get my credit card out, and then as I'm thinking about buying it, I look at that 1-point-something gigahertz processor.
1.3.
Yeah. And I go, 1.3. Right.
You don't want to have buyer's remorse.
It stopped me. And I mentioned this, I think I mentioned this Wednesday on the show, that I need to get past that in some way. But that has been something that stopped me from kind of pulling the trigger on that box. I really like, in the UK, they give you $100 off. And I'd really like to see, at $200, that's a palm, I mean, that's a touchpad, right? You just buy it at that point. You know, at $200, you buy that server and you love 1.2 gigahertz.
Yeah.
Well, it would probably work for a small business where you're just serving up data. But if you're a home user that is also wanting to play with movies and videos and stuff, I'm a little nervous. But I saw that, and I went and I downloaded their owner's manual off of HP's website, and I was checking everything out then. But then, you know, beyond that, then you also, at least in here, the one at 304, you were going to have to upgrade the RAM because it only came with 1 gig. And then you were going to be putting in at least 3 drives. I would figure you'd just populate all 4, but
yeah. Cost-wise, I upgraded it to 8 gig of RAM. The 2 2-terabyte enterprise drives and a Windows Home Server license came to about $1,200.
Yeah, so if you went for a $300 unit, right?
Right.
Yeah, but if you went for domestic grade drives, it'd probably come down to about $700.
What did you put in there for drives?
Western Digital Enterprise. I was going to go for Hitachi UltraStars, but they didn't have 2 in stock.
No. Okay.
So I figure Western Digital owns Hitachi, so the technology should be there.
Yeah. You start out with a $300 unit, and by the time you're done, you're at $1,200. And it's like, what could I buy for $1,200 straight up and get that same amount of storage?
Yeah, the thing for this guy is, there was also 2 1-terabyte USB external disks to run his backups to him. So, but for him, you know, he's just shelled out, you know, good as $4,000 to get his data back from a hard drive recovery. And he spent $1,200 to future-proof himself moving forward.
That works, I guess.
I guess I would prefer, and Andrew, I think it's a great build, but I'd prefer, if I'm going to build it for me, I'm going to, and this will come full circle to what we talked about earlier, is I want to probably put that on a box that I could put like up to 16 gig of RAM on and maybe run a Core i3 that I could virtualize on top of. And that gives me a few more options from a server perspective to be able to do either some testing or use VirtualBox to virtualize whatever, future-proof it basically, to allow me to get a little more out of it. And yeah, I'm going to spend a little bit more, but I can get more out of it from a testing perspective. Now, your small business isn't going to do that, right? So there's no need to ramp that thing up to get it done. But for us tech guys, I have seen the benefit, huge benefits in using hardware like that to do some testing before you go live with the stuff.
So you wouldn't have any problem loading VirtualBox on top of 2011? Is that what you're saying, Jim?
No, I would none at all. Wouldn't hesitate. It's the processor that I'd be most concerned about on that. In fact, because, you know, the base is just Server 2008 R2, so that's fine there. Mm. And it's the processor and the RAM that really matter with VMs. Yeah, and, well, it's really the RAM is the most important thing. Mm-hmm. You just have to have a crap load of RAM.
Well, I wasn't looking at it from that perspective. It was from the perspective of the security of your production data or your essential home data. You're using the box that that's on also as a test platform. That's what I was
saying. Yeah, but those VMs are fairly well isolated.
Yeah.
So it's not, you know, you look at that, especially the way VirtualBox does its virtualizations. It really does encapsulate the data inside a container. And it doesn't really leave or go outside of that container. So it's really no different than any other music file or any other ISO or anything that you're storing on that box. Anyways, it's just another file to the file system. So I would, and you know what? I'm sure somebody smarter than me could say it could, but it's the way I see it. It's a really nice solution to be able to do that, and I would not worry about my data on the box at all.
Yeah, for what it's worth, a couple of guys at work run that hardware with VMware ESX running on them up to 4 virtual machines. And it seems to handle it okay. You don't want to allocate more than 2 gig of RAM per virtual machine.
Right.
But with a full 8 gig load, you know, one guy's running a domain controller, a SharePoint server, a Windows Home server, and a workstation for doing his TV recording.
On that little microserver?
On the microserver.
All right.
And it's still only, and he reckons that with a kilowatt on it, it still only draws about 50 watts.
That's pretty impressive. I would not have guessed that for that processor.
But the other thing on that box is I was reading on HP's UK site the other day. It's about to get a facelift, so it's going to come out with the Turin X2 processor as an option or an Intel processor as an option. So I think there's going to be an option of an i3, i5, i7 as well. So it's about to hit the market that we were just talking about.
Well, an i3, and it's I think it's a great deal. I mean, at least for me and my comfort level. That's right.
Yeah. But, you know, even running 2011, transcoding a video out to the Xbox and running full tilt, the thing was only drawing 44 watts. So that's the other appeal to me. My current home server draws about 180, 190 at idle because it's running on full-on PC hardware. And, you know, with the green push that I've got going on here with the solar panels and everything else, it's kind of appealing to try and lower the footprint.
Yep. Hey, my Hyper-V server has 8 VMs running on it. One of them being, like you had mentioned, a VM that I have running TiVo server, where it downloads all my shows from TiVo, saves them, but also converts them into a portable version. It also runs Media Center and PlayOn.
Okay. It's doing a fair bit of work.
That one's doing a fair bit of work. Then my son, I gave him one to use, a Windows 7 Ultra 32-bit, and he runs some of his games on it. Some of his online games.
That's a great idea, Mike.
You may not like the idea. He wanted to have 2 characters in the game at the same time. So this gave him that, and what it does for him is he can have that thing running and it not deteriorate the performance on his computer. He wanted me to build him a second machine just out of some of the parts I had, and he's going to run both machines there. And I said, no, better than that, I'll give you a VM on the Hyper-V. It'll actually be faster than an old hardware you were going to have, and it won't burn up more power.
Yep. Although, if you've got a kilowatt plugged into your virtualization host, when he's running his game at full tilt, do you see the power consumption go up?
You know, I actually have a kilowatt installed on it, but I have not tested it with, you know, him doing it and him not doing it.
Yeah, because that's one of the curious things for mine. If you look at what a power load does when you transcode a video, it goes through the roof relative to it idle.
Hey, Mike, let me ask you, if I can, about your Unraid upgrade. Did you get around to doing it?
So,
No,
hold on. So I go to do the Unraid. I got that switch, that card, which is a PCI Express card. Mm-hmm. And for whatever reason, I was thinking it is the little tiny piece. I'm looking at the wrong screen here. Little tiny PCI Express thing, you know, not the one you put the video card into. Yeah. But it won't fit into that. So obviously it needs to go into the 16X, which is fine. I don't have a video card in there anyway. I plugged the thing in and it decided I'm just going to reboot with the thing plugged in, but nothing hooked up. because actually I forgot to pull up the spreadsheet that is on there, so I know where all the drives are. So I said, oh, crap, I got to reboot. I have not been able to reconnect to the thing since. So actually, when this show's over, when this show's over, what I need to do is power the thing off, turn the power off on it, and then reboot it, and then see. I don't think it's going to be a problem. I think I just need to do a hard power reset. You know, sometimes that fixes some of your problems rather than just powering down and rebooting. You got to do a hard power reset.
Okay.
Because it appears to be running fine when I have a little monitor hooked up to that, my whole rack of computer servers. I have a monitor with a 4-port switch that can go between them. And I can see it. It looks like it's running fine. I just can't see it getting an IP address, and I can't connect to it.
Okay. Well, so, to be continued, I
guess. To be continued, we'll
ask you,
yes.
We'll ask you again next week.
Yes, ask me again next week. Sorry.
Continuing saga. Well, guys, we do want to wrap it up, but I want to ask you guys one thing. Anybody know anything about heat-assisted magnetic recording technology? This has to do with hard drives, and it has to do with sticking a laser on the read-write head of your hard drive. Basically, the idea is that a laser pointed right at your hard drive platter heats that platter up, and something about doing that allows it to write more securely, more definitely to the platter, and something in that whole thing allows you to pack even more data onto a drive. So beyond just the perpendicular magnetic recording scheme that the hard drives are using now, this laser technology, heat-assisted laser magnetic recording, will extend spinning drives' capacity even beyond what it could possibly be just using current technology. So look for that. Supposedly it's coming. It's been coming for years, honestly. This is something that's been around for about 7 or 8 years. And as far as people working on the actual application, getting it to work with a hard drive, but this actual information about heat helping data being written to a hard drive better has been known for a while. It's pretty fascinating how they just keep finding things, isn't it?
It is.
You know? Yeah. Yeah,
I had seen a title about that in one of the IEEE journals, but it was one of those things I didn't have the time to read through it. You could probably do a search at the IEEE library.
Okay, I'll have to take a look. Somebody, I was actually listening to somebody talk about it on another podcast about a year ago, actually. This guy was just describing it. He says, watch for this, it's coming. And he says, this is the next thing that's going to take us a little further with the spinning drives before we reach that point where you can't pack that any more tightly. Otherwise, you get bits flipping their state. So, interesting stuff. Well, like I said, I'm going to have to read up on it a little bit more so I can actually present this a little bit more.
Tim says in chat, 10 terabyte hard drives, here we come.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe.
So you never
they're
know.
Well, they're up to a terabyte per platter now, which is
right.
Which is a step up from the 667 or so that they were at for a bit of a time here. So
didn't Seagate release a 4 terabyte the other day?
I did see that. I didn't read too much about it, but I mean, I imagine we got to get to a point somewhere where we're not spinning platters anymore.
Yeah,
larger SSDs.
Yeah, I imagine,
it's at a cheaper price.
Yeah, cheaper and smaller and more compact and more solid state and more all that stuff to make it work right.
Yeah. Well, the thing about the SSDs over a hard drive is that recovering data from them is a lot more difficult, if it's possible at all.
From an SSD?
It's a lot harder to get data back from an SSD once you've got a problem. You know, if you've got a hard drive, you can mail it into to establish recovery companies.
Yeah.
And they can probably get it back from you.
Or put it in the freezer.
Or put it in the freezer. Yeah. Which, if you do that, don't count on it really working really great after that. But if you get your data, as I did one time I was actually successful doing that. And
it only takes once.
Yeah, right.
That's all you need.
Data. You're
not
going to
use that thing again
anyway.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's it. I do this 6-inch drop methodology. You know, you hold it off the desk, and you just drop it. And sometimes that frees up platter of the arm to spin again. Now, once you turn that thing off, it's never gonna start back up. So you better have a dock sitting around ready to start pulling that drive off of it. So we should talk about all the crazy recovery methods. What do you got Andrew?
This Hitachi drive here spent about 2 hours in the freezer before it went into a dock and had all its data pulled off it.
Really? So that worked for you, huh?
Yep, froze it for 2.5 hours, pulled it out, smacked it into a USB adapter, and it got every single file off it. Couldn't even read it before.
When I did my recovery the same way, I stuck it in the fridge overnight in a baggie with a USB cord sticking out of it, coming right out of the side of the refrigerator. I says, I am not taking this thing out of the refrigerator. I don't want condens. Listen, this is my thought. I'm like, I don't want – I'm very smart here. I'm figuring this out, right? I don't want condensation happening. I know this thing is going to heat up, and once it hits the air, it's going to condense. And I says, I'm going to leave it in the baggie. I'm going to leave it in the freezer or the fridge. I can't remember if I stuck it in the freezer. I might have actually stuck it in the freezer. But anyway, that's how I did it, and I did the whole recovery. And that thing would run for a minute before it would kick off when it was not in the freezer, right? So, I mean, it heated up, and it. So I says, well, let's try it. Got nothing to lose. And that's how I did it. I'd use like a 10-foot USB cord to go from the little mini refrigerator over to my bench and got the data, all of the data off. Yeah, it was so cool.
That's awesome. Yeah. That's good.
Okay, we want to see pictures of this.
There's no pictures. There's no pictures.
This is a government operation. Blog post, though, right? How I froze my drive to get my data back.
Yeah. Well, no. I could just see a giant Frigidaire with a cord coming out of it and plugged into a computer. That'd make a fantastic picture. That'd be great wallpaper.
Yeah. It would be. Well, guys, we'll wrap this up. Jay and John, appreciate you guys joining us. And, of course, it's your first time. Yep, hopefully it was a positive experience for you.
I have actually done a search, and I found VirtualBox, and I'm going to have to read up on it. It may show more than what I was getting with the Microsoft virtual machine. So
give it a try. If you have any questions, you're always welcome to contact me. I use it a lot. There's a bunch of us around. So, Jay, thanks for coming out and joining us.
Thanks for having me.
We'll let folks know if you're listening to the recorded version of this podcast. We do. Rich and I try and do this, and we're trying to nail down a time. And Rich, this seemed like a pretty good one. So
it does. Yeah. Saturday night.
We'll start.
All the old folks can't find anything to do, so they sit around, they have computers, which they probably do any night of the week anyways.
You're welcome to join us. It would be nice to, if you sent me a note via Google Plus and find me out there. If you can't do that, just send me an email, podcast@theaverageguy.tv, and we'll figure out a way to get connected